Pardon the interruption, but I'm Mike Lobontoni. I am so sick of Charlie Sheen. The guy is everywhere. When the show's gonna stop putting him on the air?
And Tony Kornheiser, probably when he stops talking about tiger blood, fire-breathing fists, urine tests, F-18s, goddesses, trolls, tattoos, Vatican assassins, Adonis DNA, cryptology, white gold, droopy-eyed, armless children, rocket fuel,
all right, all right, all right, all right.
And by winning...
Stop.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Enough. Enough.
I'm telling you.
What is any of that? It's not connected. He's a lunatic.
He may be, but I watch the Today Show every morning just to watch the latest Charlie Sheen video.
One part of the book that I found really fascinating and tremendously educational and enlightening, because I'd never even known a lot of this stuff, was when you get into the robotics part and talk about the ancient computers and the ancient robots and stuff. I never knew that robots and computers went so far back until I read the book. I was stunned by this.
Absolutely. And whenever we were talking about that, I had a glimmer that ancient civilizations, I think we talked about this before, Tim, were much more advanced than possibly we give them credit for.
Yeah.
Part of our sort of arrogance in the 21st century is to look back to ancient peoples and saying, weren't they very primitive? Weren't they very backward? They didn't have all the things that we had. And they had just as much and maybe more. And you have only to look in a number of books and you'll see that the ancient Babylonians had batteries and were aware of chemical reactions and all sorts of things. They may have had things which we don't have and we have lost over the ages. But they certainly had ancient computers, and we know that because one of their computers has been salvaged off the island of Antikythera in the Greek archipelago. And that was discovered again in 1900 when the wreck of a Roman ship, which was carrying a Roman general back from a siege in Greece, was wrecked. And on board was a defensive mechanism or a computer, which corresponded to calculating the movements of the stars, and was probably used also in calculating troop movements. It was a very basic computer, but it was a computer nonetheless. And it had been captured by the Romans, and the general was taking it back on his ship to Rome. Now, we know that there was another computer also used in defenses. Both of these computers were designed by the Greek mathematician Archimedes. And we know that Archimedes had designed a number of computers for the defense of certain cities. This allowed the defenders to calculate movements of tides, movements of the planets, and movements of troops. And so these were being used time and time again. But we also know that the ancient Chinese may well have had some sort of mobile computer-guided vehicles, because we know of a thing called the Chai Yu, which was used in quarries and was it's described as a dragon which ate rock and excreted rock, which is chomped up. And it was probably some sort of automated quarrying machine used by the ancient Chinese. Now, we can't actually date what time this was being used. And we do know that it lived in the inhospitable mountains where there were many quarries, and that it ate rock, and that it spewed out rock. So we suspect that it was probably some sort of automated and perhaps even computerized ancient machine, which could be used for various things. And when it died, its engine simply gave out. because they talk about a dang, and it was sealed in a cave. Nobody has ever been able to find, where the cave is. And somewhere up in the inhospitable mountains, there may be an ancient machine. But certainly we suspect that all sorts of ancient computers, ancient automatons, there was talk of a great colossal figure known as Thallos, who appears in Greek legend, who was a man of bronze, and defended the coasts of Crete against invaders. Now, if you have seen some of the early 1950s films, such as Jason and the Argonauts, you will know that he appears in these, and he had a stopper in his heel, that he was powered by a sort of black fluid, which was almost like black blood, and whenever the stopper was pulled out, this blood flowed out, and he became weak. And this is how his enemies defeated him. But he was supposed to be the great man of bronze. But we do know that there were all sorts of mechanical devices. For instance, in 1377, an automated angel in London was supposed to have crowned King Richard and Richard II. And this was witnessed by the people. The angel came out and placed the crown on the king's head as a symbol of God's power. And you had all sorts of other ancient sort of mechanical devices among the early Japanese. For example, you had a mechanical orchestra which could play. And you up in the 1700s, you had in France a mechanical flute player who was almost indistinguishable, it is said, from a human. And you had all sorts of mechanical devices, a lot of them for entertainment, and a lot of them, as science began to take over, as a wonder. And these were placed in museums and in the courts of various rulers, simply to amuse, entertain, and astound those who came to see them.
Now, these, how many of these sort of like robots are still around anywhere? Are they still in some museums?
There are some in museums in Germany, and there was some taken in France. The Antikythera mechanism, which was the ancient computer, I think was taken to one of the big European museums. The name escapes me at the minute, but certainly. Things like the flute player, which was created by a gentleman, a Frenchman called Jacques de Vaucasson, stood in the Museum des Idées, or the Museum Académie des Sciences, which was a branch of the Académie des Sciences in Paris, for many, many years. From time to time, you can go to places like Munich and see some of the remnants of some of these devices. Of course, one of the things which placed these things out of the public eye was the stance of the church.
Yeah, I was going to mention
The church, and I'm thinking here of de Vaucasson, was visited by the church, who was told to stop making them because his creations were too perfect. And as I say, the flute player, which he made, was so perfect that it was almost indistinguishable from a human being, and the church became alarmed. So a number of these great, in answer to your question, a number of great, these great devices were actually destroyed on the orders of the church, but bits and pieces of them can still be seen in places like the Academy des Sciences in France or in some of the museums in Germany. Most of the early devices are now more or less lost to us.
Yeah, yeah, it makes you wonder, like you said when you started answering the question, just really how advanced the ancient peoples really were. I'd love to find out more someday, you know, and be able to find that
the
out.
The ancient peoples, I suspect, were much more advanced than we think. As I said, there's a tendency to think of them as very, very backward. But as I said, computers could be used by Greek generals to calculate movements of troops, when was the most appropriate time to attack, and things like that. Most of them were very, very basic, but they were still computers.
And one little sort of thing that caught my eye, and I figured if anyone would know more about it, it would be you, and you mentioned it briefly in the book, and that's the Voynich manuscript. Talk a little bit about this.
The Voynich manuscript, yes, indeed. The Voynich manuscript takes its name from a bookseller, Voynich. This is a mysterious book which nobody has actually ever been able to translate. It turned up, I think, in the mid-1920s, or the early 1900s, anyway. And it was sold by this gentleman called Voynich. And it is a whole collection of unintelligible writings with pictures. Now, nobody can relate the pictures to whatever sort of writing it is. And code breakers have looked at it, and code breakers have been unable to break the language that's in it. During the Second World War, code breakers were handed a whole number of things. For example, code breakers during the Second World War were handed the Celtic Ogham alphabet, or the Celtic Ogham writing it, to work out an alphabet from that, which they did. And we were able to get at least some purchase on Celtic writing. But they were unable to translate the Voynich manuscript. And it remains as unintelligible and as impenetrable as whenever they first saw it. So nobody knows who wrote it, nobody knows why it was written, and nobody knows what it says. So it is that book. It is. I would stick my neck out and say it is probably one of the only books that nobody knows what it's about, and nobody knows who wrote it, and nobody knows why it was written. It remains. It can be seen, or facsimiles of it can be seen. I think there's one in the museum in London. But once again, nobody knows when it was written. Some people say it's very ancient. Some people say it has been written by the medieval alchemists, because they wrote all sorts of books in code. To disguise what they were doing, because the church took a very dim view of their early science and their early experimentations. So they wrote in code. Some people say some people say it is a forgery, that it is not, that means nothing, that it was written at the end of the 1800s, simply as a bit of a joke, and it has fooled everybody since. But nobody knows what the manuscript itself says, or why it was written, or what it does. So unless you and I, Tim, can sit down and work something out, it will remain a mystery.
Is it like available to buy, like to read and to try for yourself?
I'm not sure. As I say, there are copies of it, and I've seen facsimiles of it. These, a couple of these were actually in private collections, and they were not the original text or the original manuscript, but they were in a couple of private collections, and I think there's one, I think it's held, the original is held in the museum in London.
Yeah.
I don't know whether, I have never went on to Amazon and see, can I buy the Voynich manuscript? There's books about it, but I don't know whether you can get the original itself. Maybe if you and I broke into the museum in London, we could make a fortune.
Sounds like a plan. Sounds like a plan.
Could be.
And to sort of like bring it all full circle here, as the book closes out, you get into the, you know, the emerging world of cloning and stuff like that. It seems like, you know, here finally the human race may be reaching a point where these fears and concerns and the psychological worries about man-made monsters may actually start to come to fruition. It might become a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. We finally have the ability to create this life, and now our worst fears may actually happen, it seems.
Well, once again, the creation of life has always been viewed as a sort of double-edged sword. The good things, which, I mean, for example, if you cloned, let's say, and I think this was the background to the cloning of something like Dolly the Sheep, which Ian Wilmot did. He named her Dolly, by the way, because he was a great country and western fan. He named her after Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
That's just by the by. But the idea that it could produce milk with certain enzymes, which could perhaps cure a number of ailments or diseases within the human race, or that it could produce some sort of fine meat, which would be free from all sorts of problems, and I think that is part of the idea between genetically modified grains, that it can that there's plenty of it, and that it can feed a starving world, things like that. Those are the good points. But then there's the bad points. These things can develop out of control, as it has in certain moral overtones, has taken away from the supreme creator, because man is now setting himself up as almost as a god, because he can do that, and where will he stop? And I mean, that I think is a genuine fear for many people. Where does he stop? Can we produce a race which is almost indistinguishable? Supposing you wanted a son who had blonde hair and blue eyes, could you order it over the internet?
Exactly, yeah.
And whenever it came your baby's turn to be born, it could be born the way you actually wanted it. And are we in danger of producing a series of mail-order children? You could say, you could go to your doctor and say, I want a baby born with a great brain capacity, so that he or she will be a genius. Or you could say, I want a child born with a great musical ability, so that he or she will be a great musician, or something like that. Are we in the, and people say that's usurping individuality. You're making people to order, and stuff like that. And you're going down a very dangerous road, and there is merit in that as well. So I think the fear has never gone away. What will we create? Will it be less? Of course, there is also the less than perfect argument. Will it be less than perfect? What will it? We mightn't get what we order at all. We might get something monstrous. What happens if we create a super soldier which has all the elements of a beast? Supposing we, like the Jaguar Man,
Yeah.
Which somebody sent me recently. Are they, what happens if the Jaguar takes over? And he's more Jaguar than man. And you're back into the old werewolf. What happens if he has powers beyond anything we can control? And what if he, like the golem, develops a will of his own and turns against us? So all these fears are there, and these are all legitimate fears. But these fears have been about from the earliest times. People have asked, what would it be like if we could create something and made it good? Because the potential is there. And we talked about robots. Robots, in many of the early science fiction stories, were the excellent servants who were untiring and who worked untiring so that we could sit about and read the paper and do whatever. And that is the good side. That made life easier. It made life better. But there's also the other side, the double-edged sword, where it turns against us and can overwhelm us, and it's stronger than we are. It's like the monstrous sun in the attic waiting to come down.
That's right. Yep. And so much more is detailed in the book. Man-made monsters, a field guide to golems, patchwork soldiers, homunculi, and other created creatures. People can get that pretty much anywhere, I presume. I just saw it on Amazon. And
you can get it on Amazon. It's published by New Page Books, and it's available on Amazon. It's available on Barnes & Noble, and it's available at all good bookshops. Mind you, I haven't seen a bad bookshop yet.
Well, I'd be remiss if we didn't put over also the artwork in the book by Ian Daniels. Just amazing stuff in there. He did the artwork in Lost Lands and Forgotten Realms, right?
Ian, I have done 10 books for New Page, and 9 of them have been with Ian.
Oh, wow.
I know Ian quite very well over the years that I've been working with him, and we'll talk about the book whenever New Page decide, or whoever it is, decide that they want the book. I say, well, here's what we're going to be doing. What do you think? And he'll say, well, what are you going? I send him up chapters as I do them, and he'll send me back artwork. And I have, he says, what do you think of this? And I have never been had to turn around to him and say, I don't like that. Every one that he has sent me down is terrific. Covers, he's done the cover, he's done everything, and everything has been terrific. I can't praise his work high enough. And he's a very nice fellow.
Absolutely, yeah. The artwork is just amazing. It's breathtaking how detailed it is, and especially in this book, terrifying. Some of the pictures are just chilling.
Yeah, well, I sent him up the chapter, and he rang me, and he kept saying, well, what do you think we should do? And I said, think about this. And he keeps saying, and he keeps sending me down stuff, and we're thinking of new books, and he keeps sending me down. He says, have you thought of this? Have you thought of that? And a lot of the stuff I haven't thought of. And his stuff inspires my writing. My stuff inspires him.
Nice, absolutely. And before I let you go, talk a little bit about Dark Fairies, because that one came out over the summer, and I haven't got a chance to get my hands on it yet, but I want to definitely read it. So give me a thumbnail on that, on what that's all about.
Okay, people ask me why did I do it. I come, as you may know, Tim, from a very remote area of County Down. We lived in mountain country. Now, Tim, if you could see the gray in my beard, you would know that when I was growing up, it wasn't yesterday. So, what we might term superstition was still very rife when I was growing up, and people believed in fairies and creatures like that. Now, we have been conditioned, I suppose, by Walt Disney. He has a lot to answer for. To look on Tinkerbell and the Seven Dwarfs and most profanely, Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a new page once again got in contact with me and said, "Will you do a book for us?" And I was sitting with Mary, my wife, one night, and Darby O'Gill and the Little People came on, and my son was sitting watching it. And I turned to them both, and I said, "Those are not the fairies I remember." Because in my part of the world, fairies were feared. They weren't like Tinkerbell and, or any of the seven dwarfs. They were things which could do you harm if they took a mind to, and they were creatures that had to be placated. So when New Page said, "Will you write us another book?" I said, "Well, what about this?" And I said, "Fine, go ahead." So I wrote about dark fairies, and it's about the dark side of the fairies and what they might be able to do to you, and it's a sort of corrective to the Walt Disney stuff.
Nice, nice. Yeah, it sounds fascinating. It sounds really mind-blowing in the sense that I'm probably sure there's a lot of stories in there that I'd never even heard of before and will definitely paint a different picture of fairies than
absolutely. And there's stuff from all around the world because we tend to think of fairies as sort of Western European sort of or Western sort of. But, I mean, you have fairies in your part of the world too, Tim. You have the Nunahe, which are the little men who live in deep in the forest in places like North Carolina and stuff like that. You also have demons and creatures from Japan who take away children, and we could do another program on the fairies alone.
Absolutely, yeah, and we will sometime in the future for sure.
Look forward to it.
Now, obviously, like I said, you had a lot going on the last couple of years since I last talked to you, and this interview is going to be posted in the beginning of the year, so we'll sort of pretend like it's the beginning of the year. So here we are at the start of 2011. What do you have, you know, in the pipeline? What do you have cooking on the stove here for the new year?
Well, everybody asks me that. This year I have written 5 books.
Wow.
At least I've lost count of them, actually. But I've written at least 5 books. I'm going to take a short break, I think. I always say that. And I look at Mary and I say, "I'm very, very tired." And she says, well, look, sit down and take a bit of a break. Whenever somebody rings you up and asks, "Can you do a book?" You book, say no. And people ring me up and say, "Can you do it?" And I says, "Yes, certainly." We are looking at a number of options. I did say to New Page, who are one of my publishers, "Look, I would like a wee bit of a break." But we are looking at, by the same token, I sent them away a whole series of ideas. I've just finished a thing which they're doing for an anthology. It's about ghosts, and I'm looking at poltergeists. They're taking a number of authors and asking them, would they look at ghosts? So they got back to me and said, "Would you look at poltergeists?" So we're looking at 3 cases of poltergeists in that. I have been busy scripting comics. I used to work in comics, so
oh, wow.
There might be something coming out in the new year on the comic field. And I've been designing books for Barron's Educational Publishing, and there's a set coming out on zombies and I think magicians and angels, all coming out in the new year. And there's a couple of new ideas coming out, which I don't want to say because they're still considering them, with the New Page. So I've enough to keep me going. Rest assured that there will be a book coming out in the new year.
Very interesting. Absolutely. Yeah, very interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing what you've got in the pipeline. I'm struck here because I'm looking at your bio that it says at age 14 you left school to become a grave digger.
I left school at, over here you could leave school at 14 whenever I was growing up. You can't do it now. But I left and worked as a grave digger. People ask me how I got into all this dark side of the road sort of stuff. And I said, I suppose it dates back to that because we used to do a thing which was called breaking graves. Now, that meant that I was assigned to some of the mountain parishes where burying ground was at a premium. And whenever a fresh burial came up, there were a number of graves which were unmarked and had not been used for burial for a while. So you went to what was called an allotment book. As long as the grave was unmarked, you went to this allotment book and I'd give you the records of who was buried there. And if there'd been no burial for over 100 years, or no record, you were entitled to open this and use it for fresh burials. Some people wouldn't do that, but I mean, I didn't mind it, but I only ever got scared once, and that was this is quite true, and that was once when I was digging up a grave which had been used for a burial before. And you dug up old bits and pieces of coffins. You never saw much. There was a guy who worked with me made a fortune in wedding rings, which he dug up. but that's beside the point. But I dug up the lid of a coffin. And it must have been a very wealthy person who had been buried in it because the coffin, the inside of the coffin was greatly lined. And the lining had been torn away on the inside of the lid.
Oh, God.
And the marks of the fingers were still in the wood. Whoever had been buried there had been buried alive. And which was not uncommon because I was not... not all that long ago, in a house, in a big house, in which there was a bell, which was connected to a crypt, and the people who were buried there could, if they came to, could ring the bell, and we get two expressions from that: saved by the bell, and a dead ringer. So. That was my experience as a grave digger. But I worked for the best part of a year digging graves and breaking graves and doing that sort of thing.
Wow, that's just remarkable stuff. I'm still sort of, my jaw hasn't picked up yet from that story about the claw marks inside the grave. That's terrifying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And that terrified me, and I think I stopped grave digging after that and became a lorry driver.
I can see why. Wow. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Well, mm-hmm. We're just about at the end of our time here, so let me thank you once again for coming back on the show. It's always a pleasure talking to you. We got to get you back on again much quicker than we did from between season 3 and season 6 because I just so much enjoy talking to you, and I'm really excited that you're putting out so much stuff, and your word's getting and you know, word about your work is getting around so far and wide over the last few years since we first found you here on the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Tim, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you and your listeners.
Absolutely. I hope we can have you back again.
I would be delighted.
That does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Big, big thanks to Dr. Bob Curran for coming back on the show. Fascinating material from him on the man-made monsters. You definitely want to check out all of his different books. Since he doesn't have a website, though, you're going to want to go to Amazon.com and punch in Dr. Bob Curran or Man-Made Monsters, and you'll be able to see all of his different works. So check them out, folks. Trust me, they are very, very cool books. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback. Before I dive into the mailbag, I want to thank all the folks who have sent some seriously encouraging emails after last week's sort of crisis-filled end-of-show ramblings from me. I can tell you right now, as an update on what was going on last week, I am now free from retail hell and can start devoting all of my time once again to BOA for the near future
and I am looking forward to really diving back into Banal of America, and I'm excited to have this fresh start in a big way. And I want to thank all the folks who wrote to us, you know, wishing us well, telling us not to stress out so much about when the shows get posted, and just generally writing some seriously encouraging emails, long ones too, not just like, hey, keep it up, man, you're awesome, but like really long and thoughtful and encouraging emails. So thank you very much, folks. I really appreciate it. As I said, I am now free from retail hell, and BOA is my A number one priority as we kick off the springtime season. Somebody on the forum pointed out how stressed out I sounded at the end of last week's program. Hopefully you hear sort of a less stressed out version of your friendly host. I'm feeling a lot better this week. I'm feeling a lot better looking forward to the future, and hopefully we have weathered the ridiculous storm that was retail hell. Now let's get down to business and check out some of the emails we received here at BOA HQ. The first one comes from Chris, and here's what he has to say. I'm a rather new listener to your show, and I don't recall how I came across it, but I'm glad I did. I think I've heard Joshua P. Warren refer to you a couple times recently, but I probably came across you as a result of looking for something else while doing an internet search. I've started listening to your podcast while driving at night and enjoy your interviews. So I heard episode 607 before I heard 606. I'm recalling the negative feedback you got in 607 regarding your previous conversation with Nick Redfern and Greg Bishop, and how it made you think you might drop the year-in review of ufology. Then, after listening to the actual interview, it made them sound like a bunch of crybabies. I think your two guests were spot on, and you too, with what was said. Piling up additional reports and files doesn't really advance ufology any further, and what we need is more information, not data. You have good interviewing abilities and a good sense of humor. That's why it bugs me to hear you lower yourself by inserting unnecessary references to fuck and fucking. You don't need to do that to be a good interviewer, unless you're trying to become another Howard Stern. It just sounds out of place for a high-quality show like yours. Perhaps you do it just because you can. I know Joshua complains every now and again about not having a web show, so that he can say all the things he wants to say. Whether that's content or cursing, I don't know. But you don't need to do that. It doesn't offend me so much as it just sounds out of place, especially talking to such high-profile guests as you do. That's all. Best wishes, Chris. Long one there. I'm tired just from reading it, but here is my response to Chris. First of all, thank you for writing in, Chris. Much appreciated, and glad to hear you've recently discovered the show. Don't have much to say with regards to the Ufology Year in Review episode. Want to highlight your email, though, because it does show that there are two sides of the coin with regards to that episode. And I'm really kind of psyched that I got so much feedback, both positive and negative. I mean, we got people talking, and that's really the point of doing the year in review and sort of cutting loose as we did on that show. I mean, if nobody said anything about it, I'd be more concerned. But the fact that we got such vehement reactions on both ends of the spectrum is really awesome to me. Now, with regards to the swearing on the program, one of the long-running threads here at the end of the show, you can count Chris among the con folks to the swearing on the program. You know, I don't know, I feel like I should at least explain somewhat that when we swear on the program, when I swear on the program, it's never intentional. I don't sit there at the beginning of the show and say, oh, this is going to be great. This week on the show, I'm going to say fuck like six times. It's never like that. It's just something that happens. That's just the way I talk in a normal conversation. And as I was saying to somebody recently on this very subject, I sometimes feel like the better the interview, the more likely it is that I'm going to swear, because the more the idea that we're putting on a radio show fades into the background and it becomes more of a conversation, and then you hear more of the real me, and then you hear me swear just because it's a natural part of me talking to this person. And I kind of like that about the program. I think that's what the pro swearing folks have to say as well about that. I mean, I don't set out to do it on purpose, and believe me, I know that the swearing hinders the program in some instances, and I've had that on my mind at times, but really, I just try not to even think about it, and whatever happens during the show happens naturally. I will point out, and hopefully help Chris out a little bit, he has a plug here at the end of his email for his website, biblicalapologist.blogspot.com, so, you know, check out his blog, biblicalapologist.blogspot.com, for more from Chris. Next email comes from Kip. No hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. I'll keep this short and sweet. Your podcast is amazing. Keep up the good work. I just started listening this week, and I'm addicted to it like crack. I'm interested to hear how you interview some of your more controversial guests. It's admirable when someone can sort the wheat from the chaff. The questions you ask are by far the most intelligent around, particularly the Jacques Vallée interview. Anyway, I could ask a million questions here, but I'll shut up. Peace out. Kip. P.S. Did you quit smoking? I can't remember hearing the click, click of the lighter in the later episodes. And the Tracy Twyman interview is depressing as hell. Well, thank you for all the accolades, Kip, first of all. Really appreciate those. Anytime someone compares your product to crack, I think is, you know, a landmark moment for any artist. So I really appreciate that. And I don't want to ruin the surprise, Kip. I don't want to spoil future episodes of the program. So I'm not even going to answer your question here about whether or not I quit smoking. You're going to have to tune in to find out. He's going to be very disappointed by the time he catches up with the rest of us. And yes, the Tracy Twyman interview is rather depressing, but also very fascinating. I had a lot of fun talking to Tracy Twyman, and stay tuned. She may be back on BOA Audio soon. So thanks for writing in, Kip. Enjoy the BOA Audio archive. Dig in and fill your mind with some BOA Audio there, seasons 1-5. And the final email this week comes from Michael, the hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. A paranormal skeptic on BOA. I listen to and read BOA because you let the person have their say without muscling in on their thoughts. Now you have brought in the unwashed to tell us no. That's not how it is. Every bump in the night isn't a multidimensional cryptid from an orbiting mothership. Bravo, sir, bravo. It is this sort of open-minded truth-seeking that keeps me coming back and contributing to your cause. Well done, Tim. Michael. Of course, Michael is talking about the newest column at BOA, The Paranormal Apostate, by Bruce Priddy. Yes, we brought a skeptic in to the mix on BOA to share his thoughts on why, you know, what we're hearing, what we're being told, what we're seeing on the internet with regards to the paranormal may not be all it's cracked up to be. I like to think of myself as fairly cynical and kind of skeptical, really, about the paranormal. And I think it's important for not just BOA, but all the different paranormal sites and media outlets to really give a voice to some of these people who are, they're really more in line with us, folks. They're really sort of, you know, wanting to know the answer to these questions, but certainly not biting on every worm that gets tossed into the paranormal ocean. I'm looking forward to seeing what else Bruce Priddy brings to the table, because he was once a believer in a lot of paranormal stuff, and now he's much, much more skeptical about it. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he has to say. I'm looking forward to what he has to write for BOA. And I'm looking forward to hearing what the BOA readers think about his contributions to the website. Bruce is just the first in a wave of new folks who'll be coming to BOA in the next few months. New writers, fresh columns coming from a whole bunch of different folks at Binal of America. Stay tuned, folks. And that does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Listener Feedback. Big thanks to Chris. I'll try not to swear so much. Kip, I did not quit smoking. There, I spoiled it for you. And Michael, who is a fan of Bruce Priddy's new column. If you want to be a part of future editions of BOA Audio Listener Feedback, here's how you do it. You write to boaaudio@hotmail.com or go to binallofamerica.com, binallofamerica.com. And click the contact button. And of course, if you're looking for something a little more interactive, you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. Lots of great folks there talking about the world of the paranormal as well as pop culture. It is BOA's paranormal playground, theusofe.com. Check it out. And I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, so befriend me, follow me, and poke me if you'd like. That's all good, and I will add you as a friend or a follower on those social network sites. Up next is the thanks portion of the program. Allow me to roll through the list of the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff. Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, our contributing cartoonist Andy Carolan, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. And, of course, we've got to add him in here because it's just a force of nature and a force of habit. But our newest staff member and our newest columnist, we just talked about him a moment ago, Bruce Pretty, author of The Paranormal Apostate. Since last time you heard from me, we've got a whole bunch of new stuff up at BOA. Leslie weighs in on a couple of big issues right now in ufology, the MUFON shakeup, as well as the Emma Woods story. The illustrious Tina Senna finally weighs in with her thoughts on the origins of the unknowable species and other mishaps, her long-awaited look at Bigfoot. And, of course, the debut of The Paranormal Apostate by Bruce Pretty, titled Who Is This Asshole Anyway? An Introduction. Bruce, come on now, you just made me swear, and I broke my promise to Chris moments ago. So, I'm a liar and a fool. And we've got Richard Thomas coming back with some new stuff in the not-too-distant future, as well as new stuff from Regan Lee and Marla Pena. Stay tuned to BOA for all kinds of cool stuff. We're working on some serious improvements to the website layout that I'm finally going to be able to devote some time to here over the next few weeks. So hopefully we'll have something really cool for you by the end of the month. We say it every time here at the end of the program, and I like to think that the BOA staff is living up to those words. If you're only listening to BOA audio and you're not reading the columns at Banal of America, then you're only getting half the story. Now comes the part of the show where I take off my hat and pass it around to the BOA audio listeners and ask for some donations to the mothership. There's two ways you can do that. You can go to banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the PayPal button on the left-hand side of the screen. Or if you don't trust PayPal, you can simply send your donation to Tim Banal, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And if you're going to do that, please include an email address so I can thank you and make your donation payable to Tim Banal and not Banal of America. That would be much appreciated. You can find the mailing address also printed at BOA on the left-hand side of the screen. I know it's been a touch-and-go season so far, folks, but trust me, we are getting ready to roll out some awesome stuff for you here now that I can devote my full focus to Banal of America. So the more help we can get in fueling those upcoming gears, it would be greatly appreciated. And, of course, as always, I must make the point that no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the website, the audio series, and all of our fun and hijinks up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers, listeners, and supporters the world over. Next week on the program, we've got a massive edition of the show, and we're again covering another area in the world of esoterica that sort of hangs out on the fringes. I'm talking about the Ouija board, folks. We're going to be delving into the Ouija board, and our guest is Robert Murch. He really is one of the world's most respected names when it comes to Ouija board history. He has done some amazing work looking into the origins of the actual Ouija board. It's not just the talking board, but the Ouija itself, the American Ouija board. He knows all about where it came from, how it evolved, and where it has gone in the last 100 years. So as you can imagine, there are just tons of avenues to go down in a conversation like that, and I do my best really to cover all of them in this interview. I haven't sat down and edited it yet, but I did enjoy the conversation quite a bit and found it to be particularly revelatory in a number of areas. That's Robert Murch. He's on the next edition of BOA Audio. You can find it only at banalofamerica.com, and hopefully you'll be listening to it very, very soon. With all that said, I've got to rest my pipes here. I feel like I've been talking forever. Thank you so much once again to Dr. Bob Kern for coming back on the show, to Chris, Kip, and Michael for writing in for BOA Audio listener feedback, and for all the folks who've been writing in with their music offerings. Don't stop sending those, folks. We are sorting through them as I speak, and we'll have some big news on the BOA music issue very, very soon. Thank you to all the folks who've been sending in some seriously encouraging emails the last few weeks. I really appreciate them tremendously, more than I can say here at the end of the program. And, of course, all you folks who are listening right now, the hardcore BOA audio listeners, the folks who stay all the way to the very end, you guys are the best. You are the fuel that drives the machine. Thank you for your support of the program. Thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.